Olaso. As you are anticipating, this afternoon we'll return to awareness of awareness. And we have these four phases, which I think you're familiar with now. But I want to come back to the simple point, and that is this is in fact the simplest of all the shamatha practices we're investigating, and probably the simplest of all shamatha practices, period. Because there it is, it's just staying home. And so for all of the elaborateness of Tsongkhapa's mind, I mean, tremendously, one could say, complex mind, if his writings are any indication of what went on in his mind. But when he discussed this practice, he did so with just that one phrase. Rest in the sheer luminosity and cognizance, sheer cognizance of awareness. Just rest in that. And that was the whole instruction. So it can be very, very simple. So I'm feeling a little bit torn right now. Whether we just keep it simple like that, or I recently spoke with someone and said, still not getting it, still not getting it. In which case, words can be useful, right? To couch this in the framework of early Buddhism, the Pali Canon, get a good conceptual understanding, and then go into it. Couch this into the context of the eight types of consciousness, the alaya vijnana, substrate consciousness, the klishta mana, the afflictive cognition, and then on into manas and so forth. And so there are various ways of approaching it, which I'm happy to do. But if it's not necessary, I'd rather just meditate. So I'm a little bit torn right now. Because I spoke with one person, quite clearly, not clear. Not so clear. Not getting it. Not getting access to it. So what shall I do? Shall I talk? I'm always happy not to talk. Really very happy not to talk. What's that? We can do that. Why don't I just go straight first? Ah, here comes Klaus. Why don't we just wait a minute? So, no, let's wait. That's what we can do. We'll just go straight to the practice, that first phase. And then, if people are still having problem, not quite engaging and so forth, then raise exactly where the lack of clarity is. And then, depending on how much lack of clarity there is, then I'll respond. But I'll respond to your question rather than coming up with a preset kind of set of things to say. Okay? So, welcome, Klaus. So as there are these four phases, what I'd want to emphasize is that all of the elaborations of the practice, and that is the withdrawal, release, in various ways, these are really preparations. These are preparations for going for the, again, I would say the marathon, the long term. And the long term is utter simplicity of just awareness holding its own ground, remaining in its own place. You've heard it so many times now. And that goes also for directing attention up and to the sides and so forth. All of those are preparations to loosen up the mind, to expand the mind, to clarify the mind. The oscillation business of the release to overcome excitation. The inversion to overcome laxity and dullness, right? But if you're there right in the moment, awareness of awareness, and you're not having problems with laxity or dullness particularly, you have that confidence that you're resting in the awareness of awareness, then you just stay there, right? If you find that you feel you're drifting off a little bit, getting a bit nebulous, that's when you can invert and then release until it passes, and then you go back to simplicity, okay? But whether you take an elaborate route like Padmasambhava taught with these four methods, or a very simple route as Tsongkhapa taught, just resting in that sheer luminosity, either way, where you're going to be spending a lot of time is just, once you get into the flow of it, is just resting in the awareness, holding its own ground. Okay? So finally, I mean, one can talk a lot or one can talk a little, but when all the talking is finished, it is very, very simple. Okay? So let's just go to the practice. Let's begin by settling body, speech, and mind in their natural states as we've done before. Emphasis on relaxation and stability with mindfulness of breathing before we venture into the main practice. In order to effectively practice the mindfulness of breathing, one needs to bring to the practice a quality of ease and looseness in the body and mind. All the more so for settling the mind in its natural state, a sense of spaciousness, looseness, non-grasping. And now all the more so for this practice, lightness. So let your eyes be at least partially open. And have a sense of letting your awareness come out into the space in front of you. But instead of directing your attention to the space of the mind or anywhere else, just let your eyes be open and let your awareness rest with no object. Appearances arise, but don't deliberately give your attention to any of them. remain, as it were, in neutral gear, not moving forwards out into the sense fields, not moving inwards into the mind, just resting without focusing on any object, any appearance, just sustaining a flow of mindful presence in the present moment, without distraction, without grasping. Whatever thoughts do come up, just release them instantly. To the best of your ability, maintain a flow of non-conceptual, non-discursive presence of mind. As you are simply present, a very immediate, very intimate reality may rise up to meet you. Without elaboration, without any need of being named, but we can give it a name, and that is awareness, the sheer, raw, unmediated experience of being aware. Rest in that knowing of knowing, which by nature is clear, bright. Now, insofar as you find yourself prone to laxity or excitation, then you may find it helpful, at least now and again, to resort to the oscillation of forcefully, with single-pointed attention, with some real effort, withdrawing your attention from all appearances, sensory and mental, withdrawing your awareness right into itself. And as you concentrate, inverting your awareness upon itself, this will likely arouse greater clarity, overcome any kind of dullness or sense of being spaced out. Coming right into the nucleus of knowing. Bright, clear. And insofar as you're prone to excitation, being carried away by distracting thoughts, the same old rumination, the other aspect of the oscillation, of utterly releasing your awareness into space with no object, releases that energy underlying the turbulence of the conceptual mind. When you do engage in the oscillation, sustain very gently but continuously the flow of mindfulness, of awareness of awareness. If you find it helpful, you may conjoin that oscillation with the rhythm of the breath. It does entail a bit of multitasking, but if that keeps you on track, do it for a while until you outgrow it, no longer need it. And then you may set the rhythm of the oscillation at your own pace, unrelated to the breath. Experiment with breathing through the nostrils or the mouth, whichever way gives you a greater sense of ease, of looseness. given the intensity of this practice, it's very easy to find oneself involuntarily inhibiting the breath or forcing the breath. Introspectively, periodically check up on the respiration to see that it flows unimpededly and effortlessly. Well, not so. Among the many methods for developing or cultivating shamatha, and within the context of developing versus discovering, this is one, as I've mentioned before, this is really about as straight a discovery approach as it gets. Because in a way, you're really not trying to cultivate vividness, because the very nature of awareness is luminosity. And the word in Tibetan for luminosity and clarity and vividness is the same term, right? So you're not cultivating, you're just resting in what is already there, the sheer clarity of it. And then awareness, when it's freed of grasping, when it's not caught up in cognitive fusion, in grasping, awareness on its own is still. Well, the word for stillness and the word for stability, that's also the same term in Tibetan. So we're really not trying to cultivate vividness or cultivate stability here, but releasing everything that obscures the natural luminosity of awareness and distracts us from or carries us away from the natural stillness of awareness so that we can discover the innate luminosity and stillness and awareness itself and thereby, in a way, discover the substrate consciousness and in so doing, discover shamatha. Right? So it's really simple. Right? Now, this practice is the one, and then I'm going to stop and just open this up. In all the other practices of shamatha that I've been introduced to, practiced, and so forth, they all have a vector. You're attending to something. It could be the space of the mind that's still to something, a Buddha image, a bindu at the heart, a bindu in the navel chakras, whatever it is. And so as you have this rope of mindfulness, that's the classic metaphor, the rope of mindfulness that's connecting your awareness to the object of mindfulness. And what connects it? Mindfulness, right? Then you have that, so I'll make it like a finger, my index finger. And that, so this knuckle here, this is the awareness. And then that which the tip of my finger is touching, that's the object of mindfulness. So with that, if you imagine, so there it is, but you imagine it's touching the meditative object, then introspection is coming orthogonally in from right angles. And it's monitoring the flow of mindfulness. Okay, that's your quality control. So it's not attending to the meditative object. Mindfulness should be doing that quite sufficiently. It's not attending to the awareness itself. It's monitoring the flow of this engagement, this flow of what should be a flow of non-forgetfulness, of engaged attentiveness, and monitoring to see whether it's falling into laxity or excitation, and then we apply the antidote as needed, right? But you can see it's looking at the finger. It's looking at the finger from the side, right? And seeing finger, are you straight or are you not? Are you wandering off? Are you withdrawing into yourself? So are you wandering off into excitation? Are you withdrawing into yourself, not in awareness of awareness, but imploding into laxity? Right? Which then is the loss of clarity. Now, when we're doing this practice, there is no finger extended out to some object that you're attending to. You know the practice well now, at least conceptually. You're staying home. So in this practice, I haven't seen much emphasis, or sometimes it seems to be excluded altogether in the various classic teachings, oral instructions, and so forth, on introspection. And maybe that's because there's no finger. You're not monitoring the rope to see whether it's slack or whether it's too taut, and so forth. There's no rope. You've coiled the rope in on itself. And so if you're right there in awareness of awareness, of course you must be aware. You must notice whether you're falling into laxity or into excitation. But if you're there, you're there. Something like that. So you don't, if this is the most unencumbered, the most unelaborated approach to shamatha that I know. And to be resting there and know that you're resting there, to know that you're attentive, you're engaged, you're knowing, to know that your mind is clear, that's sufficient. And the rest is all passive. It's just that glowing ember. I like the image. I don't know whether it's any good. But that glowing ember of your awareness. And just don't do anything. Just rest in that and let it melt down through the layers of your psyche. And just come all the way down to the bottom and come to rest in the substrate consciousness. Right? But in the process of that trajectory of just your mind settling into its natural state, your mind melting into the substrate consciousness, you're not even attending to the scenery what kind of emotions are being dredged up, memories being dredged up, thoughts, hopes, fears, all this stuff, what's happening in the body, what somatic experiences, how's the energy moving, and all of that. Whatever. No interest. You're just staying right there and not going out, not deliberately going out. Okay? So, is that clear? If it's clear, then I don't need to elaborate at all. That's enough. But if you're still having a hard time connecting with it, then there are more words that can be used. But I have to say, I'm not overly eager to use them. Happy to use it if it's useful. So how's it going? That's the first thing. I'll attend to these written questions. But first of all, how is this practice going, especially in terms of this first, simplest, and directly to the point method that we just did, following directly from Padmasambhava? How is that going? Anybody? And if it's going marvelously, then you can keep your hands down. But if there's any problem at all, a lack of clarity, difficult of access to it, now's the time. I'd love to help if I can. Yes, Anna, way back, way in the back. Microphone's coming.
Thank you. I may be following my own method, right?
You're following all methods?
My own method.
You're following your own method.
That's why I'm asking.
Oh-ho.
So I start with mindfulness of breathing.
Yeah.
Then, once I'm in, I know I'm surfing.
Surfing?
Surfing, coasting, relatively.
Okay. You're coasting, yeah. Okay. You're in the flow. Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
My mind goes and come.
Yeah.
But I don't lose the flow. Then there is a bit.
There's bit. A break?
Bit. B-E-A-T.
Beat.
A bit.
A beat, okay.
Like a clock.
Like a clock, a tick like a clock.
And
okay?
All of a sudden, the breath becomes much shallower.
Yes.
I lose sense of largely the body.
I miss that. You lose sense of?
The body.
Of the body, yeah.
And I think I am in the mind resting in its own place.
Uh-huh. What are you attending to at that time?
I may have. This is the funny thing. It isn't when I'm concentrating on the breath. It's if I have broken the attentiveness.
Yeah.
There is something happening, and then I jump a bit deeper.
A kind of discontinuity so that, and I'm just trying to understand.
Yes.
I'm not trying to direct you now.
Yes.
There's kind of a discontinuity such that you were attending to the breath, but then when the breath becomes very shallow, you disconnect from the breath, and you're just resting in the awareness of awareness. Is
well,
that correct?
No, I think I am in my mind, my own place of the mind. Then I wait there.
I don't know what that means. The words that I've
used. Settling the mind. Settling the mind.
Oh, you're in the mode of settling the mind in its natural state.
Don't ask me why I know it, but I think I am there.
I simply want to understand you. That's all I want to do.
Right.
And so at this point, what I'd like to know is what you're attending to. At this point, are you attending to the space of the mind and the events arising in it or not?
Yeah, well, yes.
You are?
All
okay.
of a sudden, I'm there.
Okay, good.
And then, if I can stay there,
yeah.
which has happened two or three times,
yeah.
it doesn't happen very often,
yeah.
because I'm not keen on awareness or over awareness,
uh-huh.
then there is another...
Discontinuity,
and boom, I go even in something else that I think may be awareness of awareness.
And what are you aware of at that time? What are you attending
Nothing.
To?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing
at all?
Well, I'm aware, I'm aware of that I am there. But I don't see anything except a point.
Except thoughts?
No, I see a point.
A point?
A point.
A point. A punta. A point, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Does it have a color? Is it a white point, a red point?
The vividness is not as good as previously.
Yeah, but I ask a question.
It when is...
I'm trying to understand still.
It is grayish white.
The point is grayish white. Okay, that's good. Yeah. Okay. And where is it?
I think I told you already. I see it like through a telescope. At a distance.
At a distance, uh-huh. Yeah. No, there's nothing wrong with that. It's all good. It's
Thank
all good.
You.
Sure. Shall I respond now?
Please.
Okay, good. Very good. So I mentioned before that these three practices, mindfulness of breathing, settling the mind, awareness of awareness, are like Russian dolls. Like Russian dolls, right? And that's what you've just described. Except the last point is not awareness of awareness. I'll give it a name. It's awareness of a bindu. A bindu. And bindu is a Sanskrit term and it means a dot. But I like to be very fancy, so I call it bindu. So you were attending to the breath, discontinuity, and it's as if your awareness imploded away from the body, withdrawing in from the body, into the space of the mind. And then there's another discontinuity, and you disengage from the many thoughts, images, and so forth coming up. But instead of having no thought, no image, you have just one. And that is this grayish-white dot, or a little orb, something like that. Correct? Yeah. So you could conceivably achieve shamatha on that dot. You could. In Tibetan Buddhist practice, they'll often place the dot someplace that will kind of give it turbo power, like putting the dot inside your heart chakra. But I would be very careful with that. Because you do that with a lot of intensity, you're going to bring a lot of prana into the center of your chest. That's like playing with nitroglycerin. That is, nitroglycerin can be very useful, but you can also blow up things you didn't mean to blow up, like your body. Right? So that at that point, this is all good. I mean, and you gave a very clear account. So if you are so inclined, it feels natural, you're drawn to it, you'd like to, just focus on that dot. Then that's a shamatha practice, focusing on a dot. And it can be in the space in front of you. And that's a perfectly good object. If you're drawn to it. It's so important that we are attracted to the method that we're devoting ourselves to and not feeling we just have to, right? And so if that's where you like to rest, you can. That is a legitimate object of meditation.
It happens. I'm not particularly keen on the dot. Uh-huh.
Well, if you get keen on the dot, you have my permission to stay. Now, I understand. I think you've explained it very well, and this is all good. And then the question becomes, if you would like to stay with, I know it comes up spontaneously. It wasn't like, I think I'm going to go for a dot today. You know, it happened by itself, right? But once it's happened, if at that point you would like to focus on the dot, you can. That's a legitimate. It's a legitimate object of shamatha. It's not what I'm teaching here, but I've never said that, you know, the only legitimate ones are the ones I'm teaching. That's not true. However, if you would like to go back to one of the three methods, then that's clearly not mindfulness of breathing. It's clearly not settling the mind in its natural state because you're focusing only on one dot. So that's not that either. If you would like to go return to this practice, which you actually said you're not inclined to, but awareness of awareness, then what you do is once that dot is there, things have gotten simple. Because now there's just one dot, right? So now your world is simplified. Now you simplify it even more. And then you say, release it. And let your awareness, almost as if with a yo-yo, sometimes you can send the yo-yo out and it stays out. Well, now just and pull the yo-yo of your attention away from the dot and let it come home. You're welcome. Good. Oh, yeah. Is it for the rest, everybody else crystal clear? In which case, boy, I get a break. Uh-oh. Just when I thought the forest had been mowed down. Andreas, we'll start with you.
It's very unclear, but I because I kind of, I just think and feel and do many things that I'm not supposed to do. That's what happens most of the time. So I got lost in thoughts or feelings or things like that. Mm-hmm. So, and I, it's like, I probably hear your instruction, but I don't get the experience and I don't know what I can do.
Yeah, very good, very good. In that case, I would take a step back. It's like trying to drive up a very steep hill in fifth gear. And you may have an excellent automobile. It's just the wrong gear, right? Because it's going, in English we call it lugging. It's just not the right gear for this hill. So what I would suggest is for the time being, I would back off from it. I mean, I invite you to do the meditation when I'm guiding the meditation. Try your best. So you get a bit of introduction, you hear the words and so forth. But then you can just take one step back, bearing in mind that each of these practices is complete in itself. If you're drawn to, you feel confidence in settling the mind as natural state, that's enough. You never need to practice awareness of awareness. That will take you all the way to shamatha. Or if mindfulness of breathing, if you connect with that, that works well, it's beneficial, relaxation, stability, vividness, that's enough. That's enough, right? So I understand, and a major reason for this is in this practice, there's just nothing to hold on to. And we have a very strong habituation when we're paying attention to something. You know, the habit of having a vector, just a long habit. So for the time being, I wouldn't worry about it. I just wouldn't worry about it at all. Give it no concern. Take one step back. And so I'll ask you, settling the mind into its natural state, where you are attending to thoughts, images, and so forth, whatever comes up, when nothing's coming up, attending to the space, does that work well? How about mindfulness? That's fine. And again, it's no problem. Yeah. And now among the three, so let's just take a step back. Because again, this is not, among Western people that I know, the ones who have gone the furthest along the path of shamatha. Okay, not all of them, but some of them. Mindfulness of breathing. Stage 7 is really pretty formidable. Straight mindfulness of breathing. Really going well. Now others have gotten that far also with awareness of awareness. But, so among the mindfulness of breathing, how does it go when you're focusing on the at the nostrils?
I don't do that very much. Mostly just
so, the abdomen, good. Does this get a bit tight? If you're focusing up here, too subtle, or do you just start losing it a lot?
I think I start losing it.
You start losing it, yeah. It's also subtle, especially as Anna was saying, when the respiration starts to become subtle. It's hard to hold on to. It's just subtle. Now, when you're focusing on the rise and fall of the abdomen, how does that go?
I just get lost a lot of the time, but at least I can, it's quite easy to identify, of course.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly right, yeah. So that's good. And so what I would do for the time being, all of this is good. The most important thing is that we're actually getting benefit from the practices we're doing and not making a habit of getting frustrated. Because that's really counterproductive. I know it well. I know what it's like to be frustrated and to make a habit of it, so I speak from experience. But in terms of the first two practices, especially in the supine position, where you really are relaxed in the body, the first one there, just keep on tilling the soil deeper and deeper, of that release with every out-breath, the release of muscular tension, release of the breath, and just experiencing that and enjoying it. It's not exciting, it's not particularly interesting, but it can be very helpful in just unwinding, releasing, relaxing, in a very kind of gentle way, kind of mildly enjoying the practice. And that's a full-body awareness. And then to gently introduce, like a very loving father raising your beloved child, you know, but knowing you must, you know, raise the child, not just let the child grow up wild, you know, with no discipline, no nothing, then very, very gently, then as you're attending to the right, to the rise and fall of the abdomen, that's when you start gently arousing your attention during in-breath and then relaxing with the out-breath. And then just being very patient, that in that process, coming back to the full body awareness, the infirmary, then coming forward to second gear, let's say, arising to the attending to the rise and fall of the abdomen, that you're doing the most important work you can do, and work that will help you, that is cultivation that will help you, really can help you for the rest of your life. And hopefully that'll be many, many, many years, you know, because you're still quite young. And so that would be a big investment. If you can do something now that will help you for the next 50, 60 years, that's pretty formidable. And so that quality, being able to relax very deeply, 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 and yet find that the continuity of attention, the ongoing coherence of attention without being distracted, that's getting better. You're pulled away in coarse excitation, less and less, but not by bearing down, being like a really fierce father, you know, stern, but by out of that deeper sense of relaxation, if, as the days go by, the weeks go by, you're finding, hey, I can maintain more continuity, I'm not losing it so often, but I'm not getting tight. I'm not getting tight, still relaxed, in fact, more relaxed. In fact, the composure, the ongoing continuity of attention is coming because I'm more relaxed and not because I'm bearing down harder and harder to try to fiercely discipline the mind. So this is doing the most important work. And frankly, many people skip it. I did. Again, I speak from first-person experience. The first shamatha retreat I did, I didn't do anything for relaxation. I was just thinking stability and vividness. And I was young like you, just a little bit older. And I said, I'm strong. I'm a guy. You know? I'm not a wuss. I can do this. Give me the job. Tackle it. You know? I just wound myself at knots that way. You know? And so that didn't work. So what I'm saying is, to be very patient with yourself, loving with yourself, step by step, and if what comes out of 8 weeks, and who knows how you'll develop over the next 5 weeks, that's for you to feel. That's the adventure. But if nothing more were to develop over the next 5 weeks, then becoming more and more adept at developing the sense of ease and relaxation, and out of that, gently, gradually cultivating greater composure and ongoing continuity of attention without getting tight, that'd be a great accomplishment. Really meaningful, really meaningful. And then laying a foundation for whatever you may want to do from there on, whether it's shamatha, whether it's vipassana, whether any kind of practice, you'll bring to it knowing how to cultivate that sense of ease that emerges into the stability. Okay?
But when it comes to cultivating the relaxation,
yeah,
is it okay to kind of like an anarchistic approach to that? Like
I just missed the adjective.
Anarchistic approach?
Anarchistic?
Like, anarchy, like don't try to do anything. Don't try to do anything specific, Jack. Just kind of maybe just detach from whatever is happening. Also, the attempt to control anything or to place attention anywhere.
Yeah.
Just let it all go. Yeah. Any struggle, any effort, or
right.
Is that okay to try to relax in this way?
Or? Right. I've never heard the word anarchy used in that context. It's very interesting. You French revolutionary. Sure. The answer is yes. Up with anarchy. In the following way, when you're in the anarchy mode, you're not yet formally practicing shamatha. But so what? Are you helping yourself relax, develop composure, a calmness, a looseness? In that case, yeah, you're definitely on the trajectory to shamatha. So I'd suggest two ways of doing it. Two ways. That is, in a way, prior to the infirmary. Because the infirmary, in that, it's not anarchy. And that is, you have this wild horse of your attention that's used to anarchy. But anarchy totally caught up in rumination. Just blah, 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 all the time. And that's just exhausting. So, you know, there's no reason to come here if one is content with rumination all the time. And I'm sure you're not. And so, in the infirmary, in the supine position, for example, you're taking this wild steed of your attention, which is used to just roaming all over the place, but having an ongoing commentary at all times. And you're saying, okay, attention, you can't roam anywhere, and we're going to work on releasing that rumination. But within the field of body, you can go anywhere you like. You can get to the knees, to the abdomen, the chest, up into the head, wherever you like. Roam at will, but stay within the field. Stay within the field of the body. And do in a very gentle way, be aware of the sensation of the breath flowing in, flowing out. Okay? It's not anarchy, but it's very, very light discipline. Okay? And then that whole emphasis on releasing, relaxing with every out-breath. So it's pretty sweet, but it's not anarchy. Right? But maybe something before that, and there is something before that, and that is in two ways. One, you can just be sitting or lying down. The other one, you can be in motion. And I've taught the one in motion already. And it can be very refreshing, very relaxing, loosening to overcome, the habit of rumination. And that's just going out for a walk. Out for a walk, but in the sense, not anarchy in the sense of just falling back into rumination and being content with it. Because then that's not anything except for just staying in the old habits. And there's just, then why do that? Because it's not pleasant, it doesn't go anywhere, it's not helpful. But anarchy in the sense that when you're out for a walk, letting your awareness free, out. So now you loosed your wild stallion of your attention. And if you want to look out into the visual field, you attend to the visual. If something in the auditory catches your attention, you go there. If you're feeling your feet on the ground as you're walking, you pick up those tactile sensations, the sensations within your body. Perhaps when you're outside, you pick up some fragrances. You might bring something to eat with you, who knows, if you want to have something in your, you know, for taste. But you do let it loose. But it's not just no practice at all. It is being very engaged here and now, very present with your environment, your body, coming to your senses, so to speak. Okay? So anarchy in the sense that you're letting awareness go wherever it will, but when rumination comes up, you release it. If thoughts come up, you can attend to them. In other words, it's kind of like wide open. This is kind of an open presence while you're walking. Thoughts come up, you notice them. The sound of a bird comes up, you hear it. You see beautiful cloud formations, you're aware of it. But you're just drenching yourself in the present moment with an openness and allowing your attention to rove to any of the six sense fields, including the mind. And that's a good practice. It's not shamatha yet, but it's a very good preparation for practice. And likewise, if you wish, and I actually taught this in one book, Minding Closely, my book on the four applications of mindfulness, that prior to shamatha per se, you can just be sitting quietly in open awareness. I won't call it vipassana, but who cares? I won't call it shamatha either, who cares? But just sitting quietly, and then anarchy. Anarchy in the sense of whatever comes up, as you're just sitting there or lying there, whatever comes up in the space of the mind, the sensory fields, moment by moment you're just aware of it, you're loose, relaxed, you attend to it without grasping, and without being carried away and caught up in rumination. Okay? So that would be more like a choiceless awareness. It can be useful. Many people have found it useful. And it can also be a very helpful preparation for then starting to train that wild horse of your mind so that when you really would like to focus in some direction, whether you know going back to the university or engaging with another person, you don't want to be, like right now, I don't want to have my attention just scattered, That's not a conversation. I mean, you say, Alan, get a grip. We are having a conversation here. What are you looking at her shawl for? And why are you scratching your knee? And why are you, So there are times when you do want to be, in just ordinary day life, we want to be focused. And so we move from that open awareness to a more focused awareness. But if we can bring to it that quality of relaxation, gradually composure, and then finally the clarity, then we're in good shape. So up for anarchy as a transitional phase to then gently subduing and training your attention so you can direct it at will and then sustain it without getting tight.
Yeah, I think that what I'm doing mostly now, I'm sitting in most of the sessions.
I just missed that.
I am usually sitting.
Sitting,
in
yeah.
most of my sessions. And I think what I'm doing is probably some kind of choiceless awareness or open awareness.
Okay.
Like you described, probably.
Yeah.
Like I just try to keep some, like whatever comes, whether it's in the body or in thoughts, I just try to keep some distance and and observe it. I think that's what I do to try to relax in that way.
Good. This is, I'll just come back to this point again. The launching pad here, the foundation, is going to be relaxation. I just can't emphasize it too much because we skip it so easily. I know because I did. And so if that's the most helpful, to cultivate or bring forth that sense of ease in the body, the sense of ease in the mind is just open awareness, choiceless awareness, but definitely overcoming something. Because you didn't come here just to stay exactly the same and to do nothing at all except for just maintain the status quo. Didn't need to travel around the world for that. And so what are we getting rid of in that choiceless awareness, that open presence, is we're moving away from the old exhausting habit of rumination, of just getting caught up in one thought after another. And that's a big step, right? So if that's the most helpful now, do it. And then gradually from that platform of choices, awareness, open presence, from that platform, then if you find it helpful with that sense of relaxation, then to contain your awareness within the body, and then start attending to, with some degree of continuity, the sensations of in and out flow of the breath, then you're on a trajectory of shamatha. But the first point is, the first initial phase can be very helpful.
Might it also be that sometimes the awareness of the body or the kind of the physical realm disappears, and it's maybe I kind of get into settling the mind in its natural state?
It can certainly happen, yeah.
Yeah?
The answer is yes. Sometimes I can give a short answer. The answer is yes. And especially if among the various things, you're sitting quietly in your room, there's probably not much in the way of interesting noises. That's why you're in your room rather than at a discotheque. And there's probably nothing interesting happening visually, because the idea then is that you're not caught up in that. And so among the various dominant sense domains, that is, sensations arising in the body, the visual field, the auditory, and then the mind. It may very well happen as you settle down, you loosen up, that among those, it's almost like a cineplex with different movie theaters inside, that the most interesting movie is playing in the cinema of the mind, because the visual is pretty boring. Auditory, hardly anything going. And after all, there's no image at all, just sound. And the tactile, kind of boring. But what's happening in the mind, actually relatively speaking, can be quite interesting. So as you just said, then you're, and that's why I said yes, your attention may just start to gravitate to that which is most interesting. And then if you start focusing on that, unifying your attention around that, the space of the mind and whatever arises in it, then you can move quite organically. This is a very interesting conversation to my mind. I'm listening. I'm finding it quite interesting. That you may find it quite an organic evolution or development from kind of an open presence, a choiceless awareness, and then just gravitating to the most interesting of the four cinemas, and then moving right into settling the mind in its natural state, but having enough relaxation and looseness that you're then not just carried away by all the thoughts that come up.
Yeah, I think that's probably what happens sometimes, but I've not been able to consciously kind of enter settling the mind in its natural state by myself, but this probably happens sometimes, but I was not able to, not sure how to describe it, but it's probably what you said.
I think you've described it well. It's good. And that could be a natural evolution. But for the time being, if the most helpful practice for you on this week, on this day, is choiceless awareness or the open presence, go for it. Because what you're doing there is so important for everything that comes after that. That looseness, that gentle composure. Okay? Good. Okay. Yes, we'll go to Gudo.
I think that last session of awareness made a lot more sense to me. I think I've been overcomplicating it. I was wondering if you could just very quickly give the pith instruction of what awareness and awareness is not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not everything else. That's the short answer. And what it's not is attending to anything else at all, including the space of the mind. That's not awareness of awareness. That's attending to something. There's a vector. There's a finger. And it's pointed to, that's the space of the mind. And you're looking at it, you know. Or any image. It's not open presence, because open presence is open to all the sense fields without preference. This is preference. You're withdrawn from all of the sense fields. That's a big preference, right? So, as really brief summary, when you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, you're preferring to contain your awareness within the field of the body. That's a preference, which means then you're not attending to sights, to sounds, to smells or tastes. You're really focusing on the tactile field, and within that tactile field, the sensations of breath. Go to settling the mind. Now there's a further withdrawal into space of the mind. Awareness of awareness, a further withdrawal, away from thoughts and images, away from the space of the mind, into awareness of awareness. And if you go anywhere from there, that's not doing it. You've slipped off into something else, including a gray-white point. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's no longer awareness of awareness, because it's awareness of a gray-white point. And that gray-white point is not awareness. It's an object or appearance to awareness. So we're withdrawing from all appearances to awareness and just resting in that transparent sheer luminosity, sheer cognizance. Good. Off to Don.
Just to your metaphor of dropping a hot coal on snow and it just goes down. So I have the experience of descending, but I also have the experience of watching myself descend. And in a sense, as distractions come up, sort of pushing them away, you know, not allowing them in. So there's, I'm not just descending. There's something else that's watching the descent that's active.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's, until we've achieved shamatha, or until actually it's stage 9, I think stage 9 is called single-pointed engagement. Until then, especially in the earlier stages, 1, 2, 3, 4, we're not going to be single-pointed. We'd like to be. But it's not happening. There's going to be coarse excitation. That's a big divergence. There's going to be stages 5, 6. There's going to be medium excitation. That's a pretty significant, that's pretty significant noise. And then stages 6 and 7, subtle excitation. That's still background haze, static, right? And so whenever we're picking that up, we are moving away from the object to some extent. In that microanalysis, then there are these little clusters going off and ascertaining something. So we're playing hooky. We're going AWOH, even if it's for 50 milliseconds. And we may say, if I can play with this a little bit, if a soldier goes AWOL so briefly that his sergeant, let's say, doesn't notice, it was so and he came back before anybody noticed, then the sergeant said, okay, no course excitation. That is, okay, you are here. Because you were gone so quickly, I didn't even notice that you were gone. Right? He was gone. But it was just medium excitation. And then the sergeant starts to sharpen up and have him, watch this guy. Then he goes, yeah. You were still here. That was subtle excitation. The sergeant still didn't get it because it was like that, real sneaky. But by the time you get up to stage 7, you go, the sergeant's got you. You're in the brig. So it's quite natural that there's going to be something of a bifurcation that's going on. But where you want to go, and it's through, gosh, how many times will I say it? More. It's going to come from relaxation, because the release of grasping is always going to come by relaxation and not by clamping down. The clamping down, the intensification of effort, the real focusing of attention, that's good for overcoming laxity. There is a place for it. There is a place for it. So in the so-called higher training, you remember it was the three higher trainings, Sila, Samadhi, Prajna, and how they interface with the Eightfold Noble Path. This will be very short. But they do, of course, because the Eightfold Noble Path covers everything, and so do the three higher trainings on the path to liberation. That among that Eightfold Noble Path, the three elements of the Eightfold Noble Path that fit into the container of the higher training in Samadhi, they are Samadhi itself, now simply as in concentration. Secondly is mindfulness. So right Samadhi, right mindfulness, and right effort. Right effort. And that's that tuning of the strings. Too much, and you're going to start getting jittery and going into excitation. Too little, and you're slipping into laxity. And now, what you want out of this is the samadhi, and you're applying the effort to tune the mindfulness. It will give rise to samadhi. So that's where that balancing act is among the three. The samadhi is the unification of the mind that you're really after. The method for doing so is the sustaining of mindfulness. But now, at what pitch? At what pitch? And that's where the Buddha gave the analogy of stringing a lute. At what pitch? Well, that's the tempering, the loosening and tightening of effort applied to the exertion to maintain your mindfulness. Okay? But as it becomes more and more spontaneous, less and less effort, less and less effort, then, how do you say, then that bifurcation, that fragmentation, it dissolves away, and then you just go into straight unification. Let's call that up at stage 8, deep flow. Because on a course level, you have that flow in stage 4. And that is, you're making all kinds of little forays off going AWOL. But the sergeant, which is your introspection, is still slow enough that you zip off, and it's no course excitation, right? But the medium excitation. Medium excitation, actually, it does catch your attention. And for a very brief little spurt, you are off. But it doesn't feel that way, because the sergeant is kind of coarse. So as far as the sergeant's concerned, you're always there. But if you had a really sharp sergeant, you'd say, oh, you did leave very briefly. Right?
So the sergeant
The sergeant's gone with you. The sergeant and you have both gone to the bar and getting drunk. Put it there, bard. You're quite right. Yeah, you can lose them both. You can lose mindfulness and introspection, and that's what happens a lot on stage 1, 2, 3. Yeah. Good. Oh yeah. Go ahead.
You spoke well yesterday on the subject of the interconnectedness, the interdependence between an object, its information, and the observer.
Yeah, the informed subject the process of being informed and that about which one is informed.
Okay. Is that first agent the awareness? I remember it being an aspect of awareness.
Yeah, we're going into some subtleties of Buddhist philosophy here.
But that's not my question.
Okay, the short answer is yes. Then just go on with the question.
I wonder if this concept might explain some troubles I'm having with awareness of awareness.
Okay.
The first is when you describe the oscillation and you release your awareness without...
Yeah.
Without
hand
an object.
Gestures. Hand gestures. Okay? Not like this, not like a pendulum. Like... Actually, the hand gestures are symbolic. You know, that's why you have mudras and all of that. It's not a release outward in front of you, but kind of like entropy.
Okay.
Like that. Go ahead.
If you release awareness with no object,
yes.
Does that mean that awareness will suddenly disappear because without an object, the other two cease to exist?
Not for you. What you are doing when you're releasing your awareness into space with no object is simultaneously, and I've mentioned this a number of times, that it's hard to remember things when you're doing the practice and I'm giving guidance in the practice, and you're doing, unless you're taking notes at the same time, it's hard to remember. As you're releasing, you are gently sustaining the thread or holding the thread of awareness, and therefore you are knowing something. What are you knowing? Being aware. But you're doing so with just this sense of release, but not totally and then just kind of going, I don't know, blotto or vegetative or something like that. It is a release, but you're just gently sustaining that continuity of the awareness of awareness, even as you're releasing. In other words, you're not releasing entirely, just going belly up, you know, like flaking out entirely, because that's just getting spaced out. So it's a profound release, a sense of just that release, but sustaining that. And then as you invert your awareness, then that awareness of awareness gets brighter. So it could be a little bit like this, like a bulb that gets very, very bright and then becomes very diffuse, but it doesn't go out. There's a continuity of light all the way through. Sometimes letting that light diffuse and just illuminate space all around, but with no object, and then sometimes coming right into the filament itself, where it's incandescent, and just being in that filament. Okay?
And secondly, when I disengage from all of the coarse objects to find my awareness, sometimes I can't find it. And I wonder if it's because of this moment when I released or attempted to release an awareness of all of the objects, that my awareness collapses because there's no objects.
Yeah, as you release, it's very easy when you're totally releasing to also release the awareness of awareness. And then having released it, it's almost like having a kite that's caught up in the wind. And so you let the kite go. And imagine there's a really strong wind. And the kite goes, ooh, like that. And you go, oh. You know, release the string. And then when you want to pull in the kite, whoops, where did my kite go? Because you just need it to hold onto the string. Okay, so this is why it's a little bit like that. It's not a bad image. Is you release the kite, so it goes up, 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 up. But you hold on enough that when you want to draw in the kite, you actually have a string to hold onto, and then you invert your awareness into itself. Okay, so that's probably the reason.
Yeah, no, that sounds good to me. And the other way that I've expressed this problem is... that in order for me to be aware of my awareness, I need to have an object to be aware of first.
Yes.
Like some visual aspect, and I can go, okay, I'm aware of something, and then try to disengage from that while still being aware and sometimes losing it,
exactly.
Sometimes maintaining it.
Yeah, in text after text that I've translated, at least three of them right off, immediately I can think of three texts that I've translated from the Mahamudra and Dzogchen traditions. That's exactly what they do. There's a whole sequence. Two texts by Karma Chakmet from the Mahamudra tradition, Natural Liberation from Padmasambhava in the Nyingma tradition, is they'll start out with something really coarse, a flower, a stick, a stone. And it's something you're visually looking at. It doesn't get much easier than that. Okay, can you see the stone? Which stone? Oh, you mean that story? Yeah, I got it. You know, so you definitely have a target, right? And they say, okay, you got that one? Good. You just succeeded. Give them a brownie point. Give them something. And then you go from that, which is really coarse, really easy to identify. There's a stone. And then you go, and then you eventually go to a mental image, a Buddha or whatever you like. And then you go from there. And then finally, and it's always the last stage. It's always the last stage. Then, okay, now release all objects. And now just rest without conceptualization. Just rest in the knowing of knowing. But they'll give you a lot of steps up to that so that you don't just get lost and then just sit there, where am I? What? Like that. Okay? Good.
Can I say something just to compliment?
You may. I always like compliments. I know.
It's something that I found very useful that Tony told us.
Uh-huh. This is Tony Karam from Casa de Bed, Mexico.
He's our teacher in Mexico. And he said, related to his question of why the subject of awareness and the information and the object doesn't collapse, is because actually awareness is not watching itself, but the previous moment mm-hmm. of awareness, and mm-hmm. is like a chain.
That's right. Good. That's true. Very good. Yep. Okay, Tiram, and then we'll go to Miles.
Tiram, yeah, just a quick follow-up on what Quinn was saying. Could you...
Whom was saying? Quinn was saying.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Could you kind of experientially describe, you know, we're talking about this process of moving from an object, an awareness of, say, a physical sense, then awareness of mental sense, and then into awareness to awareness. Mm-hmm. I'm particularly interested in this because before you were saying awareness and awareness is not settling the mind in a natural state with no activity.
That's correct.
That's correct, yeah. And so as a process of moving from that having an object to not an object, I'm interested in this transition. Say you're doing settling the mind in the natural state mm-hmm. and you're aware of the space of the mind and the activity. You're aware of the space of the mind,
Yes.
And also the activity that's
right.
arising.
Right.
And then... at times, as we've discussed, whether it be the beginning or throughout the process, there's little activity, like the cockroaches are under the fridge or that kind of thing. And sometimes I find, in settling the mind in natural state, after a while the activity really does kind of simmer down and mm-hmm. it is more this space of the mind that I'm kind of attending to. Mm-hmm. But then in the awareness of awareness, okay, so that's not awareness of awareness, so... Would it be possible for you to describe, say, an experiential transition from that state, mm-hmm. certainly not a natural state, with no activity? There isn't any activity. You're not rejecting it. There just isn't any. And then you want to move into awareness of awareness?
Yeah.
I'd be interested if you could explain that.
Yeah. It's exactly with that in mind that I've given these sequences in a practice that actually has no sequence at all. The practice has no real sequence at all. In the classic teachings, which are, to my mind, the best teachings, in settling the mind in its natural state, just focus on the space of the mind and its contents, maintain your mindfulness without distract, without grasping. That's it. There's no stages there. Just do it. There's no stages. And I teach, and then I clutter it all up with these stages. Okay, attend to the foreground. Attend to the subjective impulses coming in. Attend to the intervals. Attend to the space out of which these thoughts emerge and so forth. So why do I clutter up something that was naturally so simple and to the point? Is to make sure we don't miss anything. Because with too few words, we may then just be focusing on thoughts. And then when there are no thoughts, then we're not focusing on anything. We're just sitting back smoking the cigar. I'll wait until the thought comes up, you know. I know you're smoking something else, but I said a cigar. And so to make sure that we are always engaged, there's always a flow of knowing, you know, whether it's an objectively appearing thought or image, whether it's a subjectively experienced emotion, desire, intention, or even when you can't tell any activity, any emotion in the space of the mind at all, there's still something to know. And what is that? That three-dimensional, transparent vacuity that is quite distinctly the space of the mind and not visual space and auditory space and others. And how do you know you're there? Because if you're focusing on that space of the mind, here's the criterion, it's really the key. If you are quite single-pointedly focused on the space of the mind and you're getting no content apart from the space of the mind, if a thought were to arise, you'll pick it up immediately. If you were focusing on the space of sound and then a thought came up, you wouldn't notice it because you're listening, you know, listening for a sound. You're in a different domain. It's another theater. It's another cinema, right? We have a cineplex of six cinema halls within it. But you're in the right hall. If as soon as a thought, image, desire, emotion comes up, you get it immediately. Then say, then you were there. You're right. As soon as the movie started to play, you saw it immediately. That's because you were attending in the right place. Now, when you're there and you are attending to the space of the mind, you're attending to something that is not awareness. It's the space of the mind. And that is, it's spacious, has no color, but it itself is not awareness. It is something you're attending to. Just a vacuous, open space, but it's transparent, has no color, and so forth, has no shape, has no center, has no periphery, and so forth. So it has a lot of qualities, and it is transparent, and it is formless, and so forth. So it has positive qualities, and then it's free of a lot of other qualities. But it means you're still attending to something other than awareness. And so this is why I gave that sequence, and the final stage, you know, in that sequence was, okay, now just attend to the space of the mind, just to get a flavor of it. Not that that's a separate shamatha practice, but get a flavor of that, see what it's like. And so now here's the exact transition. And that, okay, I'm focused right now on the space of the mind. Thought just came up and I noticed immediately, okay, then I was in right space. Okay, now there's no thoughts. And now, I'm going to try to do a little cartoon. And what I hoped I showed was, I just lost interest in the space of the mind. No longer interested. I left the theater. And I'm back at the movie projector. I'm at the projector room. I'm right there in the source of the illumination. In which case, I'm not looking at the blank screen. I've stopped looking, stopped taking an interest. I pulled in the antenna. Like that. Okay? Good. Good, good. I think we have time for one more, and I think it was Miles. I think you had a hand, and Miles already had a question up. So if there's time, we will. Otherwise, it's tomorrow. But Miles had his hand up, so carry on, Miles.
My question is about the practice of settling the mind in its natural state.
Fine.
And the distinction between being caught in a thought and observing a thought.
Yes.
And I'm just having difficulty there because thoughts will come up, and I'll be pretty confident that I'm just observing them. But it's like, let's say a movie starts playing, and I'm trying to make sure that, am I allowed to watch the movie that's playing? Or even trying to focus to watch it more clearly, what's the difference between seeing the movie really clearly and being in the thought?
Good. I'll get the analogy again. I think the analogy is good enough, we can stay with it. Okay? So you're watching a movie. Well, remember three ways of watching a movie. Okay? One is the way that we usually pay for. And that is, if we hear the new movie has come out, let's say Avatar, let's imagine it's just come out, you've never seen it before, you've heard it's really great, terrific reviews, incredible special effects. And you see this pretty likable guy coming up, he's crippled, and so we're already sympathetic with him. And then we see him running because he's just got this cool new body. And he's so happy, and you're starting to feel happy. Oh man, that must feel really good. And then, oh man, is she beautiful? She's weird, but she's really beautiful. You know, so he encounters the weird chick, you know, and he's like, well, she's quite a babe. I'm not quite sure I'd go for her, but she is pretty. And so you're getting into the story, you know, and then you get that really gnarly dude that wants, you know, make him a tough Marine and butcher all the sweet people. And, oh, no, I can't stand that guy. He's, bad guy. And so you're into the drama. You can't stand the villain. You like the cool Marine. You love that cool, weird chick, you know, and all of that, you know, and the storyline, and you really like flying, and the dragons are absolutely, you know, radical, you know. And you can just imagine. So you're in the drama. You're enjoying it. You're getting fearful. You're happy. You're angry, and so forth and so on. In other words, you're watching the movie, right? and you're totally caught up in the drama, and this is major. You paid $10 to get into cognitive fusion, into something that's really interesting to be fused with, because it's a cool movie. I think it's a cool movie. Okay, that's what we pay movies for. But that means you're totally reifying everything. This is a two-hour, two-and-a-half-hour daydream. Cognitive fusion all the way through. And that's why it's entertaining. Okay? Now imagine you're getting $200,000 a year to be a movie critic. Your reputation is on the line here. They say this is really good, but is it really schmaltz? Is it just Hollywood garbage? Or is this really a very well-crafted movie? How's the acting? How's the cinematography? How's the editing? How's the script? How's the lighting? So you're a movie critic. And people are looking at you as a professional. And saying, oh yeah, this actor, Sam Wallingford, he's a pretty good guy. And that one's a new one. Let's see how she is. And so now you're looking at it, and you're looking at it definitely removed. You're looking at actors in computer-generated scenery, and you're being a critic of that. But you're not getting into the drama at all. You're observing from outside. You're seeing actors as actors. You're seeing computer-generated environments as that, right? And you know, oh, this guy who's playing the arch-villain, sweet guy, I had beer with him last week. Cool guy. Yes, I've got one of my buddies. He's really awful in that movie. That he's playing a villain, but he's a sweet guy. You know, the colonel. And so that's a step removed, that you're not getting caught on the drama, but you're still identifying the actors, and you're identifying the cinematography and all of that and all of that, right? So it's one step removed, and you're certainly not reifying them, because you know that the villain is not really an evil man. He's a good actor, and he's playing the villain very well. And now you can take one step removed further that nobody gets paid for, and that is you come to the movie theater, and you're seeing images, and sounds as sounds. You're stripping it naked, and you're just seeing images arising in the screen, and you're recognizing them as images. You're not going blurry-eyed, you're not going vague, but you're simply seeing appearance of a person. There's that voice there, that's voice there, and so forth. You're hearing the soundtrack, you're seeing the images, but you're not making them into people. You're not identifying that is that actor, oh, there he is. You're just taking it nakedly from moment to moment, seeing what is arising on that screen. And so, in that gradient then, okay, it's a gradient. We've had this conversation before. The gradient of grasping. The best model, and that's where we'll end, the best model, it is so close, is being lucid in a dream. When you're lucid in a dream, and I mean very lucid, then you're not just seeing images, but you are recognizing dream people as dream people. You're not getting caught in the drama. You're not getting caught in cognitive fusion thinking you, as a human being who was born a couple of decades ago, you are the person in this dream. You have not slipped your whole identity into this little persona who might last for 10 minutes and then, poof, you know, go poof, gone, right? You're not that person. You live longer than your persona in the dream, which could last 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour. And so you're not identifying with you. You're not fusing your whole sense of identity into the character you are in the dream. And you're not grasping onto anybody else in the dream as being really there, inherently there. You're not reifying them. So you're there present in the dream, and you're aware of the dream people arising as dream people, dream landscapes arising as dream landscapes, your own dream body arising as a dream body. And you're present with all of this. And imagine you're very passive in this dream. You're just a tourist. You're just a quiet onlooker. You're a witness, but you are knowing the nature of the dream all the way through without actively engaging with it. That would be the closest analogy. So when people come to mind, images come to mind, thoughts, discursive thoughts, and so forth and so on, you're lucid with respect to the mind in the waking state. You're recognizing mental events as mental events, but you're not getting caught into the drama, like watching Avatar and really enjoying the movie as the movie. You're just aware of them arising moment to moment. And here's the catch, once again. That stillness of your own awareness. The images are coming and going. They're coming and going. But your awareness is still. It's not being dragged into, caught up, and carried away by anything happening in the mind. Okay? Now, what I just said was very simple. The actual practice is much more of a whole transition, a whole set of gradations of how much were you drawn into it, how much were preferences arising, right? That subtle medium core excitation. So in this practice, if you are totally caught up in the referent of the thought, you're thinking about somebody or some memory or some fantasy, and that's where your attention is wholly now engrossed, caught up in that, you're attending to something, then that's coarse excitation. You're no longer practicing settling the mind in its natural state. This is called daydreaming, because you've completely forgotten the object of mindfulness. Because while your attention has gone there and then, someplace else, probably some other time, place in time, that means you're totally disengaged from the object of mindfulness, which is absolutely here and now. Space of the mind and what's happening right now. As long as you're attending to what's happening right now, then at least you're not distracted. And if you can tend to it without motion, without movement, the thoughts are rising and passing, moving, but your awareness is still. That means you're not only not distracted, but you're also not engaging in grasping. Because the grasping is when you start to move. You move away, I don't like it. You move toward it, I do like it. Like that. So remember that beautiful image of the falcon kiting into the wind. You're still. If you're still, you're not carried away, blown away by distraction, but you're also not moved forward or backward by grasping. Say again?
Show interest.
You are interested. Just yes, you're definitely interested. You're just not moving. You can be interested without grasping. Okay? Cool. Okay. Good. So the questions are here. They will still get attention, but I'm very happy with this. This is very, very spot on with experience, practice. So that's primarily what we're here for. And these are good questions too, but they will wait until tomorrow and at dinner time. So I enjoy your dinner. I'll see you soon.